This is Audible.
Recorded Books and RB Digital present A Treacherous Curse by Deanna Raban, narrated by Angel Mercers. To Danielle Perez, for befriending Veronica and taking her farther than I ever imagined she could go. Chapter 1. London, 1888.
I assure you, I am perfectly capable of identifying a phallus when I see one,
Stoker informed me, clipping the words sharply.
And that is no such thing.
He pointed to the artifact I had just extracted from a packing crate. It was perhaps 3 feet in length, carved of some sort of exotic hardwood and buffed to a smooth sheen. Bits of excelsior dangled from it like so much whimsical decoration. It was oddly festive. "Of course it is," I said. I brandished the item in question at him. "Just look at the knobby bit on the end." Stoker folded his arms over the breadth of his chest and looked down his nose at me.
"Consider, if you will, the length. Improbable, you must admit. Most improbable."
He was doing his best to avoid the appearance of embarrassment, but a touch of rose still bloomed in his cheeks. I found it winsome that such a hardened man of the world could have gained so much experience as scientist, explorer, natural historian, naval surgeon, and taxidermist, and still manage a maidenly blush when confronted with a fertility icon. "Stoker," I said patiently. "Both male and female genitalia have been celebrated in ritualized art since the beginning of time, and frequently their proportions are exaggerated in order to convey their importance to the peoples in question." He curled a handsome lip.
"Do not invoke ethnography, Veronica. You know how I feel about the social sciences."
I shrugged. "There are those who maintain the study of culture is just as important as the examination of a bit of bone or a fossilized snail, and do not pretend that you are immune to the seductive siren call of the humanities. I have seen you mooning over journal articles about the role of religious ritual in the decreasing populations of certain South Sea turtles."
"I do not moon," he retorted. "And furthermore, those journal entries..."
He proceeded to lecture me for the next quarter of an hour about what I cannot say, for I turned my attention to the contents of the packing crate. I had long since discovered upon my travels that men are largely the same no matter where one encounters them, and if one is prepared to let them discourse on their pet topics of conversation, one can generally get on with things quite handily without any interference. The packing crate was the newest arrival at the Belvedere, the budding museum Stoker and I had been commissioned to organize under the aegis of our friend and benefactor, the Earl of Rosmoren. Situated on the grounds of his lordship's Marylebone estate, Bishop's Folly, the Belvedere was either a glorious trove of undiscovered treasures or the storehouse of a family of madmen, depending upon one's perspective. The Earls of Rosmoren had been an acquisitive lot, haring around Europe to amass a collection of art, artifacts, zoological specimens, books, manuscripts, jewels, armor, and 1,000 other things that defied description. How we came to live amongst such treasures is a story that merits its own volume. To investigate one murder is a curiosity. To investigate two is a habit. Stoker and I had fallen into the practice of murder when our mutual friend, the Baron von Stauffenbach, had been slain the previous summer. We had uncovered some difficult truths and made a cautious alliance with Sir Hugo Montgomery, the head of Special Branch, Scotland Yard's most prestigious division. When, at the end of that investigation, fate had proven to be an unkind hussy and left us without home or employment, the current Lord Rosmoren had graciously invited Stoker and me to work for him, living on the grounds of Bishop's Folly and cataloguing his collection with an eye to one day opening the Belvedere as a public museum. It was arduous work, consisting of unpacking, inspecting, reviewing provenance, cleaning and registering each item. The beetles alone could take years. But it was enchanting. Every day offered its own surprises, and as word spread of our undertaking, donations to the collection began to arrive. It seemed that Lord Rosemoran's project was the perfect opportunity for his friends to rid themselves of items they no longer wanted. They would never send anything truly valuable. The English aristocracy are nothing if not sharply attentive to financial advantage. So we received instead a steady stream of decrepit hunting trophies and wretched oil paintings. They were of no use to us, so Stoker regularly burnt the moth-eaten trophies in the garden, whilst I arranged the portraits into a grim sort of family, giving each a pet name and taking particular delight in each baleful new addition. But the shipment that arrived that morning had been the most peculiar yet. The large packing crate had been stuffed with excelsior to cradle an array of phalluses, each more impressive than the last. Clay, leather, marble, wood. The materials were nearly as varied as the objects themselves, and the assortment of sizes was frankly extraordinary. From a modest little fellow about the width of my handspan, to the enormity I brought to Stoker's attention, they represented a thorough study of that particular piece of anatomy. At the bottom of the crate nestled a leather box with a piece of card affixed to the lid. Personal gift to Miss Veronica Speedwell. I have not forgot my obligation. With my compliments and heartfelt gratitude, Miles Ramsford. Suddenly, the mysterious collection made perfect sense. Our second investigation had saved Miles Ramsforth from the hangman's noose, and I was not surprised he had chosen to repay the debt with part of his extraordinary array of erotic art. Understandably, Ramsforth had quitted England immediately upon his release from prison, and we had never met in person, but he had sent an effusive letter of thanks, with a splendid silver watch chain for Stoker, and a promise to remember me with something even more noteworthy. My curiosity piqued. I extracted the box carefully and opened it with a rush of anticipation. I was not disappointed. Wrapped lovingly in cotton wool was yet another phallus, this one a masterpiece of the Venetian glassmaker's art. Of clear, blown glass, it was striped with luscious violet colour that gleamed like a boiled sweet as I held it to the light. I remembered it well. I had admired it when Stoker and I first studied the collection, although how Ramsforth happened to know of my appreciation was a mystery. It was a testimony to both his gratitude and his puckish sense of humour that he would present me with the costliest specimen from such a deliciously lurid collection. I brandished it at Stoker. "I was quite right about the hardwood piece," I told him. "This was at the bottom of the crate. It is the doing of Miles Ramsforth. A personal gift," I added, with a waggle of my brows. Stoker blushed furiously.
"For the love of God, put that thing away!"
"I cannot imagine why you are so bashful on the subject of the male genitalia of Homo sapiens, when you are the only one of us who can boast of owning it," I muttered, as I replaced the offending item carefully into its box, with a mental note to examine it more thoroughly in private.
"I heard that,"
he said, as he returned to the task at hand, hollowing out the remains of a badly mounted platypus. The task was messy but not arduous, so he had kept on his shirt, a rare occurrence given his penchant for working stripped to the waist. I regretted the fact that he was fully clothed, but I contented myself with the occasional appreciative glance at his muscular forearms, bared to the elbow. His shirt was open at the neck, and he seldom wore a waistcoat and never a coat if he could help it. His hair, black and waving and badly in need of a barber's attentions, was punctuated by a slender streak of silvery white, a souvenir of our most recent foray into detective pursuits. It had ended when he had been shot in the temple in a ridiculous attempt to shield me from a murderer, and the result was a single snowy lock where the bullet had struck him. Gold rings glinted at his earlobes, and one of his many tattoos, relics of his days as a surgeon's mate in Her Majesty's Navy, peeped from the edge of his rolled sleeve. He wore a patch over his left eye, a habit since an accident in the Amazon had nearly taken it from him, leaving him with slim, pale ribbons of scars that marked him from brow to collarbone and beyond. He looked like precisely what he was, a man in his prime, with a good deal of experience and precious little regard for society's expectations.
"Stop scrutinizing me as if I were one of your damned butterflies," he said in a conversational tone.
I sighed. It has been a year since my last indulgence in physical congress, I reminded him in a wistful tone. Admiring your physique is my only consolation. He snorted by way of reply. I had made no secret of my perfectly sensible approach to relationships between the sexes, namely that marriage was a ridiculously outmoded institution and that sexual exercise was both health-giving and revivifying to the spirits. In the interest of respectability, I never indulged whilst in England, preferring to satisfy my urges during my trips abroad, a discreet and wholly efficient arrangement. The fact that it had been more than a year since my last expedition had begun to try my resolve. Stoker did not judge my predilections any more than I judged him for living as chastely as any medieval monk. A brief and hellish marriage, followed by a period of bacchanalian overindulgence, had soured him on romance. Although I regularly recommended to him a restorative bout of coitus, preferably with a strapping dairymaid, a course he had yet to embrace. I considered the various fallacies, uncertain of where to begin. Ought I to arrange them by size, or shall they be grouped according to geographical region of origin? Or material? I asked. Stoker and I frequently quarrelled about various methods of organisation within the collection. I preferred a chronological approach, whilst he maintained a firm preference for theme. This time he merely flapped a hand, clearly finished with the subject of phalluses. I hefted the largest, the hardwood piece from the Pacific, scrutinising it with a practised eye. "You know, I am rather reminded of a charming American fellow I met in Costa Rica," I said, with a nostalgic sigh. I made a point of never keeping in contact with my paramours once I had finished with them, but I had very nearly made an exception for the American. I did not pursue the conversation. Stoker was in a good mood for once, something that had been sorely lacking of late. February had been thoroughly nasty, with snowfall of apocalyptic proportions and temperatures that would have caused a polar bear to shiver. We had made the best of the situation, applying ourselves diligently to our work, but both of us had suffered bouts of ennui, longing for balmy climes and sea-scented winds. Our planned expedition with Lord Rosemoran to the South Pacific to search for new specimens had been thwarted by accident, namely his lordship's unfortunate collision with his Galapagos tortoise, Patricia. She lumbered around the estate with all the grace and speed of a boulder, so how the Earl managed to fall over her was a matter never fully explained to my satisfaction. But the result had been a broken femur and months of recuperation. We sympathised with his lordship and told him we did not mind in the least, but I drank a significant amount of strong spirits as I unpacked my bag, and I suspected Stoker sniffed back a manful tear or two as he put away his maps and charts. Saving Miles Ramsforth from the noose had been a diverting occupation, but a Christmas spent with Lord Rosemoran's unruly brood of children underfoot and the rigours of a perilously long winter had nearly undone us both. Stoker had amused himself by unearthing the most ludicrous of the taxidermy mounts, while I had taken to reading sensationalist newspapers. One, the Daily Harbinger, had proven useful during the Ramsforth case, and I had resorted to bribing the hall boy, George, to bring me the copy each morning before his lordship had a chance to read it. This morning he skipped in, bearing the newspaper and the First Post, whistling a merry tune. George broke off as he caught sight of the object in my hand, his eyes round with interest and his errand forgotten.
"Here now, miss, that looks like we know what it looks like,"
Stoker cut in ruthlessly. George peered into the packing crate.
"Where are these from, miss?"
"All around the world," I told him. "They were amassed by a gentleman named Miles Ramsforth, a famous patron of the arts and a suspected murderer." He blinked.
"Imagine that!"
I put out my hand. "Harbinger, please." He gave me the newspaper before wandering to where Stoker was bent over his trophy.
"That's a funny old stoat."
"It isn't a stoat,"
Stoker corrected.
"It is a platypus."
"Why has it got a duck on its face?"
George put out a tentative finger and Stoker flicked it aside.
"This is Ornithorhynchus anatinus, the duck-billed platypus, native to Australia."
"But why has it got a duck on its face?"
George persisted.
"It hasn't got a duck on its face. That is just its face."
"Are you taking the duck off its face?"
Stoker's nostrils flared slightly, and I knew he was about to say something unpleasant. "George," I called, as I skimmed the front page of the newspaper, "what is the latest news of the Tiverton expedition?" George trotted over, his face bright with interest. He had a penchant for the most outrageous stories in the Harbinger, and the Harbinger's stories were already more outrageous than most. But he was a good lad and took great pride in his budding literacy, so I encouraged him.
"Oh, miss, you ought to read it. They say the expedition is cursed,"
he said, with an unholy gleam in his eye. From behind his platypus, Stoker gave a snort.
"You don't believe in curses, sir?"
the boy asked. Stoker opened his mouth, no doubt to hold forth on the subject of superstition, but I anticipated him. "Curses are not rational, George. There is no scientific basis for them. However, there is good reason to think that the belief itself in a curse can create deleterious effects."
"Dilo what?"
the boy asked. "Deleterious. It means bad. I was saying that the mere belief in a curse can give it power."
"Hogwash,"
Stoker said succinctly. "It most certainly is not. There are well-documented cases of individuals..."
"Exactly that. Individuals. There has been no empirical study done on the subject."
"And how, precisely, would one conduct such a study?" I asked in an acid tone. He did not bother to reply, and I turned back to George. "Tell me about the curse." George and I had become fascinated by the exploits of the Tiverton expedition in Egypt. Led by Sir Leicester Tiverton, an excitable baronet of middle years, the group had found a cache from the 18th dynasty. The burial was incomplete, but the sarcophagus of a princess and an assortment of grave goods were enough to ignite a furor of international interest. Sir Leicester had become something of an instant celebrity. A series of calamities had forced the early return of the expedition, and stories of their misfortunes had kept the reading public enthralled.
"It is said that the site of the dig was visited by one of the Egyptian gods. Can't remember his name, but he wears a dog on his head," George said, gesturing to the lurid illustration in the newspaper.
I skimmed the article quickly. "Anubis," I told him. "God of the underworld, and that is not a dog on his head, it is a jackal." I pointed him to the Greco-Roman sarcophagus Stoker and I used as a sideboard for our meals. Incised on its side was a parade of ancient gods. George had little trouble spotting Anubis.
"Is this cursed too?"
he asked. "I doubt it. The thing is a late Greco-Roman copy of a much older piece."
"Is there a mummy inside?"
"I'm afraid not," I said absently, as I studied the drawings in the newspaper. "Just a collection of early prosthetics."
What's that, miss?"
"Prosthetics, George. Fake arms and legs meant to replace those that have been lopped off."
"Blimey. But no mummy?"
"No mummy," I assured him. "And don't say blimey. It's common."
"I'm common, miss,"
he returned cheerfully. Of that I had no doubt. For all I knew, Lord Rosemoran's butler, Lumley, had found him squatting in a gutter under a cabbage leaf. But the boy was bright, nimble in understanding, and blessed with a solid ear and a head for figures. If he could curb his tendency to slang and the dropping of H's, he might well make something of himself. George turned back to the illustration.
"They say that this Anubis fellow came into the workers' camp at night, looking for a soul to take."
"Rubbish,"
Stoker said succinctly.
"No, sir, it's true,"
George maintained stubbornly. I held up a hand. "The boy is right. The director of the excavation died a few weeks ago, and now the expedition photographer has disappeared along with a diadem belonging to the mummified princess. Apparently, the Egyptian workers blamed their troubles on a curse inscribed on the princess's sarcophagus."
"Horse feathers,"
Stoker replied. "George, you'd better get on before you learn any new words of which Mr. Lumley wouldn't approve," I told the boy. He grinned and went on his way as I finished the article.
"You oughtn't to encourage him,"
Stoker said as he returned to his platypus.
"The boy already has a febrile imagination."
"No more than this reporter," I said absently. "I do not recall seeing his name before, but J.J. Butterworth has made quite a reputation for himself writing about the Tiverton expedition."
"Our man in Cairo?"
Stoker asked. "More like our man in London. This was filed here in town. Apparently the Tivertons have returned to England after John de Morgan's disappearance." I would have said more, but I broke off as soon as I caught sight of Stoker's face. Still bent over his platypus, his features had frozen into an expression so thoroughly devoid of emotion it was impossible to interpret. His complexion had gone perfectly white, then flushed a quick and violent red. I feared he was well on his way to an apoplexy. "Stoker, what is it?"
"Nothing,"
he answered, after a long moment and a visible effort.
"Afraid I was wool-gathering. What did you say?"
I pressed my lips together, holding back the question that rose to them. Whatever had caused him to react so strongly, he had no wish to share it, and I had no wish to pry. I have pledged myself to honesty in these pages, gentle reader, so I will admit that in point of fact I had a rather ferocious wish to pry. But I had learnt through painful experience that Stoker responded far better to the oblique approach than to more direct methods. Considering my extensive experience in hunting butterflies, notoriously skittish and elusive creatures, Stoker was less trouble than a chimera birdwing. I went on. "I said that the Tivertons, Sir Leicester and Lady Tiverton, have returned to England. The death of their excavation director loaned credence to the idea of the curse. The local workers have refused to re-enter the tomb, and the director of antiquities in Egypt has agreed that it is best they seal it back up and leave things to settle until next season."
"And there is no sign of the photographer?"
"John de Morgan? No. Apparently he disappeared from the dig site with his wife. At the same time, the jewel of Sir Leicester's find, a diadem belonging to the dead Princess Ankaset, went missing, and no one knows if de Morgan and his wife stole it or if they met with foul play." Stoker said nothing. His colour slowly returned to normal, and his hands resumed their work. I turned to the post, sorting the various envelopes into pigeonholes. Bills to pay. Bills to pretend I have not received. Letters to answer. Letters to ignore. Letters from tedious people. The rest I consigned to the waste paper basket. But the last demanded my immediate attention. I will admit to a small groan as I recognized the imperious hand of our sometime friend and occasional sparring partner at Scotland Yard.
Sir Hugo?
Stoker guessed as I took up the lion's tooth I used as a paper knife. Sir Hugo, I confirmed. How did you guess?
He is the only person of our acquaintance who could excite such a reaction. We are invited to call.
I skimmed the brief message. We are not invited. We are instructed. He wishes to see us, but he is ill at home, and he summons us to his sickbed. Gird yourself, Stoker. We are about to meet Sir Hugo in his nightshirt. Chapter 2. Sir Hugo Montgomery, head of Special Branch, loyal watchdog of the royal family and our sometime ally, was tucked up in bed when we arrived. His house stood in one of the quieter, leafier corners of Belgravia, so elegantly nondescript that one might easily pass it by without a second glance. I suspected that was a deliberate choice on Sir Hugo's part. Whenever possible, he opted for understatement, and I was not surprised when the door was answered by a very correct parlourmaid rather than a butler. "Miss Speedwell and Mr. Templeton Vane to see Sir Hugo," I told her. "We are expected." She did not wait for a calling card. Cap ribbons starched and snapping, she led us to the stairs, past the public rooms, and up two flights, going directly into Sir Hugo's bedchamber without pausing. The room was well proportioned and tastefully furnished with Regency fruitwood pieces and a very fine aubusson. The draperies were the colour of crushed mint leaves, and the counterpane a darker green. Against the soft apricot walls, the result was soothing elegance, but the effect was slightly ruined by the tropical temperature. The windows had been firmly sealed and the fire stoked high, so that the entire room was hot as Satan's boudoir. A pair of small tables stood next to the bed, and were crowded with bottles and bowls, various medicaments, stacks of handkerchiefs, and a spirit lamp. The smell of camphor hung heavily in the warm, damp air. Sir Hugo was sitting up in bed, surrounded by newspapers and holding a handkerchief to his streaming nose. Atop his head perched a nightcap with a lavish tassel of blue silk.
"Miss Speedwell, Templeton Vane,"
he said with a brusque nod. For the duration of our visit he proceeded to lisp as he breathed stentoriously through his mouth, but I will make no attempt to reproduce the ghastly noises he made. He waved us to a pair of chairs next to the bed as the parlour-maid waited at the door.
"What is it, Carter?"
Sir Hugo demanded.
"Time for your tonic, sir. Lady Montgomery is most particular," she told him.
He pulled a face.
"Lady Montgomery is not my mother. Get out,"
he grumbled. The maid grinned as she left, and I suspected she was as amused by Sir Hugo's pettishness as we were. I could feel Stoker suppressing a laugh as he stared in rapt fascination at the tasselled nightcap.
"We are very sorry to find you unwell," I told Sir Hugo.
"At least you have some sympathy,"
he said sullenly.
"My wife fusses, the maid bullies, and Mornaday gloats. I'll wager a guinea the little flea is sitting in my chair right now."
The fact that Inspector Mornaday longed for his superior's job was one of the worst-kept secrets at Scotland Yard. No doubt he was relishing every moment of freedom from Sir Hugo's watchful eye, but it would not do to upset the patient any more than necessary, I decided, so I ignored the mention of Mornaday altogether.
"We should not keep you longer than necessary,"
I said, setting a bright smile on my lips. You need your rest.
I need occupation,
he retorted, stabbing at the newspapers.
Do you know what is happening in my city? Murder, mayhem, misanthropy. And where am I? Stuck in bed waiting for Helen to dose me with Dr. Brightlung's pulmonary tonic and force-feed me a blancmange.
Heaven forbid we stand between a man and his wife's blancmange,
Stoker murmured. Sir Hugo reached for a pillow to heave at him, but I lifted a hand. Do not distress yourself, Sir Hugo. Stoker is merely teasing. I will drop something into his tea later to revenge you.
Make it arsenic.
Sir Hugo fell to coughing then, a hideous bout that left him gasping for breath. Without a word, Stoker went to the windows and wrenched one open just a little. Fresh, cold air rushed into the room, lightening the heavy atmosphere. While Sir Hugo regained his composure, Stoker busied himself with the spirit lamp and various bottles. After a few moments, he approached the bed, carrying a steaming bowl and a towel.
What's that?
Sir Hugo demanded.
A remedy,
Stoker said. He put the bowl onto a bed tray and set the whole affair onto Sir Hugo's lap. He draped the towel over the ailing man's head.
Now, slow deep breaths and hold the steam in your lungs for as long as you can.
I sniffed the air. Sage?
And thyme with a little peppermint oil. I would have preferred white eucalyptus, but the stuff is devilishly hard to find outside of Australia.
We chatted for a few minutes, comparing herbal remedies we had collected on our travels, until Sir Hugo emerged, snuffling and red of face, but with markedly easier breathing.
That works,
he said in some astonishment. Stoker sighed.
I am a surgeon,
he reminded Sir Hugo.
Yes, I just didn't know you were a good one.
Sir Hugo settled back against his pillows, still wreathed in fragrant steam.
Ah, oh, that is better.
He drew in a deep breath and let it out again.
I haven't been able to do that for almost a fortnight. A little fresh air and regular herbal steam baths,
Stoker instructed.
And pour out that tonic. It's poisonous stuff. I will,
Sir Hugo promised, clearly in better spirits. He looked to me.
You may be wondering why I asked you to call today.
We are entirely at a loss, I told him truthfully. We haven't meddled in so much as the theft of a tea towel since last autumn. Our amateur investigative efforts were a thorn in Sir Hugo's side. He veered between reluctant tolerance and frothy rage when we found ourselves at the business end of a murder. I could not resist the urge to tweak Sir Hugo's nose a bit. I presume it has something to do with my unwelcome connection to the royal family, I suggested. My status as a semi-legitimate member of that august group both rankled Sir Hugo and elicited his most protective instincts. Is this my periodic harangue that anything I do might reflect badly upon them? Sir Hugo looked hurt.
I do not harangue.
You have upon numerous occasions. Shall I list them?
I do not summon you to harangue you now,
he corrected.
In fact, I mean to offer you help.
Stoker and I turned to each other, blinking. Stoker, is there anything in those herbs that might cause Sir Hugo to suffer hallucinations? It is the only explanation.
I am entirely serious,
Sir Hugo protested.
I know I have been strict with you in the past. You had me arrested,
Stoker pointed out coldly.
Yes, well, your men put me into a Black Maria and hauled me to Scotland Yard like a common pickpocket,
Stoker went on.
Be that as it may, My person was searched. My entire person.
Stoker finished. Sir Hugo fidgeted.
Perhaps I let the lads go a bit too far,
he admitted. I turned to Stoker. They disrobed you?
They stripped me mother naked,
he affirmed. Well, that must have intimidated them, I mused. I had had the pleasure of seeing Stoker's undraped form on multiple, if innocent, occasions. Any man who stripped him would doubtless suffer by comparison. Sir Hugo was still gaping at my last remark when I pressed on. What do you mean you intend to help us?
I mean exactly that. Something has come to my attention that might prove difficult,
he said, seemingly at a loss.
I don't know how best to begin.
Sir Hugo, I have seen you at your bellowing worst, and I must say I am far more discomforted by this avuncular consideration for our feelings. Spit it out, man.
Very well.
He pushed himself higher up on the pillows.
I am sorry to bring to light things you have no doubt buried,
he began. I opened my mouth to ask what in the world he was wittering on about, but in that instant I realized Sir Hugo's gaze was not resting upon me. He was staring at Stoker. I snapped my mouth shut. Stoker's expression was as imperturbable as usual. What things? I demanded.
Things that might cause Stoker to be a person of interest in a man's disappearance.
Whose? I asked. But Stoker did not stir. He knew already, I realized, for there was a bleakness in his face I had never seen before. Sir Hugo went on.
A fellow by the name of John de Morgan. He was most recently employed as a photographer with the Tiverton expedition in Egypt.
At that, I did burst out laughing. What nonsense! Stoker has no connection to John de Morgan.
Veronica,
Stoker began softly. I flapped a hand. Hush, Stoker, I am berating Sir Hugo. I went on in the same vein, poking fun at Sir Hugo for the sheer ridiculousness of the notion that Stoker might be involved in De Morgan's disappearance. After a minute or two, I realized Stoker and Sir Hugo had been suspiciously quiet, the silence between them hanging heavy in the room. I whirled on Stoker. You mean it is true? You have a connection to John de Morgan? Why didn't you say?
As Sir Hugo said, I buried my dead,
he told me simply. I waited, but he said nothing more. I turned back to Sir Hugo. Very well, they have a connection, but you cannot seriously suspect Stoker of harming the fellow. Might I remind you that you are speaking of Revelstoke Templeton Vane, the Honourable Revelstoke Templeton Vane? His father was a Viscount and his maternal grandfather was the Duke of Keswick.
I am aware of his antecedents, Miss Speedwell. That will not immunise him from suspicion if certain facts become public knowledge.
I took a deep breath. Very well. We must have a clear understanding of these facts. Proceed. Sir Hugo looked a trifle relieved, as if he had expected hysterics. He should have known better. I was a scientist, after all. I had learnt early in life that facts were the only things one could truly rely upon in this world. Stoker said nothing. He merely sat and waited for Sir Hugo to speak.
John de Morgan was hired at the beginning of this Egyptological season to act as photographer for Sir Leicester Tiverton's expedition. He travelled to Egypt with the Tivertons in November and was permitted to bring his wife, as Lady Tiverton and Miss Iphigenia Tiverton were expected to join the party after Christmas. As you have no doubt read in the newspapers, he said with a twist of the lips, a discovery was made,
The Tivitans located the partial burial of a princess. 2 weeks ago, De Morgan departed Egypt abruptly, accompanied by Mrs. De Morgan. They left without a word to the Tivitans, taking only a single carpet bag each.
Curious, I murmured.
At the same time, a priceless diadem belonging to the dead princess went missing. It is the most significant piece in the collection, and it was regretfully presumed that De Morgan had stolen it.
Presumed by whom?
The Tivitans. They did not like to point fingers, but as the collection must be catalogued for the benefit of the Egyptian authorities, they had to report its theft.
He cleared his throat, resuming his narrative.
De Morgan and his wife travelled by a fast steamer as far as Marseille, where they boarded the train for Paris and then to Calais. From there they took a Channel steamer, arriving in Dover at just about midnight. They proceeded to a small private hotel in Dover where they took separate rooms, as De Morgan was suffering from ill health and did not wish to disturb his wife.
I pursed my lips but said nothing. What sort of woman accepted a separate room for her own comfort when her husband was ailing and in need of attention? Sir Hugo picked up the thread of his tale.
They slept apart. In the morning, De Morgan had vanished without a trace. At the insistence of his wife, the local police investigated, and there was no sign of him to be found in Dover or in London. Notices have been placed in newspapers around the country. Passenger lists, ticket offices, railway porters, all avenues have been pursued with no result. John De Morgan has simply disappeared.
I curled a scornful lip. I am surprised at you, Sir Hugo, for making such a mountain out of a particularly sordid little molehill. Clearly the fellow wished to be rid of his wife. He saw her safely onto English soil, which was the gentlemanly thing to do, but at the first opportunity he absconded with his purloined diadem to start life afresh somewhere else. No doubt he pawned the crown to fund his escape from England. You, above anyone, must know that it is possible to elude the police with a bit of luck and proper care. It seems perfectly simple. Sir Hugo said nothing.
There is more.
Stoker guessed shrewdly. Sir Hugo nodded, the tassel of his nightcap swinging like a pendulum.
Yes. You see, John De Morgan was not the only disappearance. When his wife came to wake him the next morning, his entire hotel room had vanished as well.
A damp little finger of horror crept up my spine. What do you mean, his hotel room had vanished?
Mrs. De Morgan insists that when they checked in, De Morgan's room was blue, with a rose print wallpaper and walnut furniture. Mrs. De Morgan tucked her husband up into bed and sat with him for some time as he fell asleep. She amused herself by counting the rosebuds in each section of the wallpaper. The next morning, when she went to see how he had fared in the night, the room was empty. And the wallpaper...
was different. I finished.
Forget-me-nots,
Sir Hugo informed us.
Rather a grim joke under the circumstances. The carpet had been changed to green, and the bedstead replaced with one of iron. The hard chair she had sat upon the night before was now a plush affair of striped yellow velvet.
It sounds dreadful, I remarked.
And nothing at all like the room John De Morgan had taken.
What of the hotel proprietor? I demanded. Surely he must have some explanation. Sir Hugo shrugged.
Proprietress, actually. According to Mrs. De Morgan, she checked them in upon their arrival the previous night. But when questioned by the Dover police, she said Mrs. De Morgan arrived alone. The hotel ledger,
Stoker said quickly.
John would have signed the hotel ledger upon checking in.
Sir Hugo shook his head.
Mrs. De Morgan signed for them both, as her husband was feeling ill upon their arrival. The only entry in the ledger bears her handwriting.
If there is no proof John de Morgan ever set foot in this country, how can you possibly suspect Stoker of having anything to do with his vanishing? I asked. Sir Hugo's expression was pained.
In point of fact, I do not suspect Stoker. But with no clear answers as to De Morgan's disappearance, naturally it became necessary to consider the possibility of foul play. And once the idea of murder was mooted, the next step was to determine if John De Morgan had any mortal enemies. As it happens, he has just one.
He raised his eyes to Stoker, who did not flinch from the scrutiny.
Yes,
he said calmly.
I hated him. But if I wanted to kill him, I would have done it openly, and let you put the noose around my neck with your own two hands.
I stared at him. In the months we had known one another, I had come to understand him better than most. Some stories he told me, others I guessed. But there were secrets within him, dark and spiny things that scuttled from the light of day. "Who is John de Morgan to you?" I asked him softly. He said nothing. He simply sat, so still, so silent, I could almost imagine he was not there. It was Sir Hugo who spoke.
"John de Morgan was the supporting partner of the Templeton Vane expedition to Amazonia in 1882.
I felt a jolt of something electric pass through my body. "He was your friend," I said, forcing the words out through lips suddenly cold and stiff. "He left you there when you were about to die." Stoker's smile was a thin and mirthless thing.
"He did more than that. He married my wife."
Chapter 3. A surge of laughter, exquisitely balanced on the knife edge of disbelief, rose within me. I smothered it as Sir Hugo gave a solemn nod of assent.
"Mrs. John de Morgan was, before her marriage to him, Caroline Templeton Vane."
My thoughts spun and tumbled. It appeared another shard of Stoker's past was coming to light, to add to the slender collection I had hoarded. I knew that he had led a failed expedition to the jungles of the Amazon, an expedition that had cost him his marriage and his honour, as well as his career as a rising star in the firmament of natural history. I had never learnt the details. He seldom mentioned that period of his life, and never without obvious pain. That Caroline Templeton Vane had left him in Brazil and returned to England to petition for divorce on the grounds of cruelty was public record. Reporters had scented blood in the water and gathered for a feeding frenzy with Stoker's reputation the casualty. If he had returned at once, he might have mitigated the damage, mounted some defence that could have turned the tide at least a little. But instead he had lingered in Brazil, healing from wounds sustained in a jaguar attack, not bothering to book passage home for 3 long years. By then the damage was beyond repair. He had sunk into obscurity and poverty, and only the efforts of our mutual and much-mourned friend, the Baron von Stauffenbach, had kept him from complete degradation. The Baron had sent him taxidermy commissions and provided a workspace, and since his death I had taken it upon myself to be Stoker's prop and support. There was a spark of genius in him, but sparks are fragile things, and they need careful attention. I had seen progress in the past months, a reviving of the spirits and the confidence that had been broken to splinters by his experiences. A surge of dislike for Caroline de Morgan threatened to choke me. I had kept Stoker hard at work, coaxing and bullying him into the best state he had known since she had annihilated him, and now her name was spoken once more, like a terrible incantation summoning a ghost that had never been entirely laid. "I believe I require fortification," I said succinctly. I rose and went to the bedside table, where I helped myself to a glass to accommodate the measure of aguardiente I poured from the flask I always carried on my person. I drank it down in one swift motion, capping the flask and wiping my mouth carefully. When I had cleaned the glass and resumed my seat, I looked at Sir Hugo. "You can prove motive. You cannot prove murder. You have no body."
"How many times must I say that I do not wish to prove murder?"
he asked in some exasperation, throwing his hands heavenwards.
"I do not believe he was murdered." "What do you think happened?"
Stoker asked, in a voice rather unlike his own. Sir Hugo passed a hand over his fevered brow.
"I am inclined to agree with Miss Speedwell. I think the fellow saw an eye to helping himself to a fortune and ridding himself of a wife at the same time. For these reasons, he took the jewel and slipped away. A rotten thing to do, but apparently the fellow had money troubles and a tempestuous marriage."
I perked up a little at this last snippet of information. "Did he indeed?"
"The members of the expedition indicated that the De Morgan marriage was not always a cordial one. They were frequently cross with one another, money being a constant source of friction."
"It would be,"
Stoker said quietly.
"John could never keep 2 shillings together in his pocket. His wife wouldn't like that."
The mention of the woman caused something green and slimy to slither in my belly.
"What does Mrs. De Morgan have to say about the state of her marriage?" I asked.
"Mrs. De Morgan is not answering questions. She spoke with the Dover police, but has refused all efforts to reach her since. The chaps there were not as tactful as they ought to have been, and the whole ordeal was too much for her. Her father came and took charge of her and has made it perfectly clear that we are not to trouble her again. Our hands are tied."
"Mrs. De Morgan cannot cope with difficult realities,"
Stoker said.
"If John left her, it would shatter her entirely."
"Perhaps she killed him," I offered pleasantly.
Sir Hugo huffed into a handkerchief.
"Unlikely. I am told she is of middling height, but slim and fine-boned. She might be able to kill a man, but she could never dispose of the body."
Stoker rose and went to the window, staring out as Sir Hugo and I continued to talk.
"Why are Special Branch involved? This sounds like a matter for the Dover police. Ought it not to have begun and ended with them?"
"Initially, we were not part of this investigation. The disappearance of one insignificant man is not enough to involve us,"
Sir Hugo said, a trifle loftily.
"But as he was connected with Sir Leicester Tiverton's expedition, and since De Morgan may have absconded with a priceless piece of historical significance, we have been kept informed."
"Not our history," I corrected.
Sir Hugo smoothed his moustaches.
"The expedition was funded and undertaken by Englishmen. If it were left to the Egyptians, the artifacts would still be mouldering in the ground."
Seeing that I was about to argue, he held up a quelling hand.
"But that is beside the point. Sir Leicester's name is a prominent one, and we were obliged to take note. I should perhaps mention there is another party who is quite enthusiastic about all things Egyptological, and encouraged our involvement,"
he said, with a significant twitch of the lips. "My father," I guessed. Sir Hugo did not like to acknowledge the relationship so openly, but he gave a short nod.
"His Royal Highness sailed up the Nile in the spring of 62.
He paused, knowing I would seize upon the significance of the date.
"When in the spring?"
March. 2 months before your birth, and some 3 months after the death of his father. Prince Albert had planned the trip as a sort of royal tour, and in spite of her grief, Her Majesty thought it best that her son carry out his duties. It was a quiet affair, with no official entertainments. His Royal Highness spent most of his time smoking cigars and reading sensational novels and having himself tattooed.
He finished, his lips tightening in disapproval. "You seem to know quite a bit about it," I said, attempting a casual tone I did not feel. 2 months before my birth, my mother would have been heavy with child and expectation of a future with my father, an expectation that died with her before my first birthday.
"I accompanied His Royal Highness,"
Sir Hugo explained.
"Special branch did not yet exist, of course, but it was considered advisable for the prince to have companions of a sober and discreet nature who could encourage him to take an interest in the people and politics of the region as well as its history."
"And did he?" He pulled a face.
"I regret to say, His Royal Highness was more interested in shooting crocodiles than in learning the intricacies of foreign policy. But he did bestir himself to ignore his mother's dictates regarding invitations on at least one occasion. He met with the local authority, Saeed Pasha, and developed rather a remarkable rapport with the fellow. There are few men as personable as the Prince of Wales when he exerts himself."
He finished. "What was he like on the trip?" I asked in a small voice.
"There are photographs,"
Stoker said, not turning his head from the window.
"A fellow named Francis Bedford took them and published them in 2 folios.
Sir Hugo said nothing, but I knew he must have been aware of the photographs. I had glimpsed my father once, in passing and at a distance. It was not enough. The prince I had seen was middle-aged and corpulent, exquisite tailoring not quite concealing his avoirdupois. But he had not always been so. He must have been handsome once, I knew, in order to turn my mother's head. She had been the rarest beauty of the age. "You have seen these folios?" I asked Stoker. Still he did not turn.
"Briefly. One of the gentlemen on the tour, Arthur Stanley, brought along a manservant named Waters, who had a talent for stuffing birds. I can mount anything with feathers, thanks to him. He showed me the folios once. It should be a trifling matter to find other copies."
Sir Hugo gave a little cough.
"I suppose I could hunt up my own set,"
he said, not ungraciously. "Thank you. I presume his travels in that country sparked an interest in Egyptology?" He nodded.
"He has been a keen observer ever since that trip, although it was Lady Tiverton's writings which really kindled his interest. He found her to be quite knowledgeable on the subject."
"And knowing his reputation, I would hazard a guess that Lady Tiverton is an attractive woman," I said in an acid tone. Every fact I gleaned about my father always seemed to come back to sex.
"Most attractive,"
Sir Hugo admitted.
"She was the foundress of the Tiverton expeditions, funding them through her private fortune and encouraging her husband to excavate in previously unexplored regions of the Valley of the Kings."
"She must be immensely gratified to have discovered a royal burial," I mused.
"She would be,"
Sir Hugo agreed,
"if she were alive. Regrettably, the first Lady Tiverton died some years ago. She was an invalid in poor health and made her home in Egypt. Consumption,"
he said with a shudder.
"Her widower, Sir Leicester, has made the find with his second wife, the current Lady Tiverton."
"That hardly seems fair," I protested. The poor woman spends her money and what little health she has pursuing a dream, and no sooner is she dead than her husband and his new wife see that dream realized.
Fate is a cruel mistress,
Sir Hugo said, ending on a heavy sneeze.